another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am really, really thrilled to have these guys on. They were on once before, and I absolutely loved them. And I absolutely love them today. And this is my guests, our David Fantle. See, David? As Mickey Mantle, I remembered.
Yeah, perfect.
And Tom Johnson. And they wrote this wonderful, wonderful book, Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. And it is wonderful. And guess what? There's a foreword by Robert Wagner, as you two fellows know him as...
RJ.
RJ.
Pretty much anyone.
Which is what he insists upon calling... You know, people calling him about 3 seconds into any conversation.
Yeah.
They're instant friends. So,
I know. How'd you get him? You went to his management place, right?
I mean, I think that, it took a while to get the interview, and it was in his publicist place in L.A. I think it was scheduled to be like 30 minutes. And I think the fact that, we got along so well or had so much commonality or interest in Golden Age stars and people we knew that the time just flew by. What was it, Tom? Like 3 hours by the time it was done?
I think it was probably the longest interview maybe that we ever did. And the funny thing in it was that his assistant kept coming in to try and end the interview politely, like saying, do you need coffee or whatever? And RJ always just said, no, we're having a good time. Come back later. So it was really, it was sort of a nice thing that he did that way. And it really proved that he was sort of into the interview. And at the very end of it, he said, do you guys have anyone writing a foreword for this, this new book that you're doing, Hollywood Heyday? And we said, no. And he said, do you mind if I take a shot at it? And we said,
What a nice thing to do. I know you guys, what you wrote down was certainly not 3 hours worth. You had to have gotten some better scoop that you did not tell us. And you probably can't, but 2 or 3 hours.
And RJ, God bless him, he's been on a couple podcasts, and he's been more than diplomatic on his stories. And I'd say that in our interview with him and in the book, there's actually more reveal than I've heard him in the last year or two on some of the interviews he's given. So I think he opened up pretty well about who he liked, who he didn't like, some relationships he had, like with Barbara Stanwyck and things like that. Talking about his love and friendship with Fred Astaire, since, I went to school with Astaire's kid. I think he just totally opened up with us. So
yeah, in fact, one of the great stories that he did tell us was that, we didn't get into the, hit him hard, obviously, about the Natalie Wood stuff. But he said that he volunteered stuff. He said it was the worst day of his life. And he said he was in a fetal position in his bed after it happened, after she died. And he was just... he said he didn't know how he could go on. And the only reason he said he didn't really end it all was because of his kids. And he said the first person to come over and sit with him, sit by the side of the bed, just, to be with him, was Gene Kelly. Came over and that's the thing about RJ. He was just, and that's why he sort of liked, talking with us, was because he was really connected to that, the old order in Hollywood. He had worked for James Cagney, working out his horses back, years and years before he even became an actor. So he was really kind of, synced into a lot of these old Hollywood stars, and he loved to talk about them. So,
I mean, he said when he was at the Military Academy in Hollywood with Peter Astaire, Fred's son, that Fred would pick him up in his Packard convertible, and it was like he was oblivious that, he went to a military school in Hollywood, RJ, with Peter Astaire, Fred's son, and RJ said that Fred would come and pick them both up in his Packard convertible. But at the time, Fred was just, to him, a father of one of his classmates. He was sort of oblivious to the fact that the guy picking him up was this, iconic film star. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, he said he didn't know who Fred Astaire was, just that he was, Pete's dad. And it was a yellow Packard in, I think, 1938 that he pulled up alongside the school because RJ was going to spend the weekend over at Pete's house, Fred's house, and Fred got out of the car, picked him up, and tossed him in the back seat. And that was his introduction to Fred Astaire as this, you know, adult, Pete's dad, picking him up and putting him in the back seat.
Picking him up.
Yeah.
Literally.
And they became, lifelong friends because not only would RJ golf and play billiards with Fred, but Fred played RJ's father, Alistair's Mundy, on several episodes of It Takes a Thief. I always get it mixed up with the
It Takes a Thief.
The TV show in the late 60s. So he got to work with Fred and socialize, and they were just really close, even with the age difference. And I should say, I mean, RJ to this day is a force of nature. I believe he's 88 or 89.
No way.
Yeah.
He's working, and he lives in Aspen. He's working in Hollywood on projects. He goes to film festivals. I mean, the guy's texting and calling, and, you know, I mean, it's just the guy's a force of nature.
Yeah.
Well, he wrote two great books, about old Hollywood.
Great stories.
And, you know, I really admire that. And he did talk about Natalie, which was funny he brought it up, but, you know,
Tom and I always say to people, you know, don't get your news from the supermarket tabloids, because that's just, you know, salacious nonsense. I mean, yeah, obviously between Christopher Walken and RJ and Natalie on that boat, there was some stuff that happened. But, you know, beyond that, it's just salacious nonsense.
Well, and it's the two courts of inquiry over many years that both, you know, they found nothing wrong on RJ's part. And I mean, you know, I know there we're in an era of conspiracy theorists and this and that and truthers and da da da. But you know what? You know, nothing has ever been found. And I think too that, you know, if there was any sort of suspicion, I think his kids probably would have, you know, if not disowned him, have not embraced him and loved him and you know, all these years.
Natalie, his daughters with Natalie are in his camp. They're very close-knit family. They're very close. And as Tom said, if there was even a hint of suspicion that there was anything there, I don't think he would have that relationship with his daughters.
Yeah, no. And he has a great relationship with them. So I, you know, I don't.
Well, I know people who think that he did something wrong. But I really believe they were drunk. There was a bunch of stuff that went on. When you drink that much, like I was saying to someone the other day, it's not rational what you do. You're not rational.
No. And the fact that she couldn't swim and, you know, all of that. It was like the, you know, no pun, the perfect storm. Tragically.
But it's not closed. The case isn't closed still. It's ridiculous.
I know. But, you know.
Well, I mean, the case isn't closed because that Dennis guy, the, you know, the captain of the ship, I mean, whenever he needs it seems, whenever he needs money, you know, he sells his new remembrances, things that have just come to him after 40 years, to the, you know, whatever TV network is working on some salacious story. So it's sort of this continuous payday for
him. Well, that's what I thought. Do you guys know Lori Jacobson?
No.
The name is
she's written books and she used to work for Jack Haley. She did a lot of stuff.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
She said that I thought that he wrote the book after Robert Wagner let him go. And this Marty chick wrote this book with him. And, you know, I'm like, how convenient now, you know?
Well, we're in an era of anonymous sources, parties, and, you know, fake news and all of this. It's all about eyeballs and whether it's TV or ears for radio, whatever, you know, can maximize advertising revenue is what's news. And so the RJ Natalie Wood story sort of still has legs.
It does.
Some years later.
And Lana Wood is out there, Natalie's sister, who is, you know, she's hugely into, you know, these theories and all of that. And she's, you know,
she's also destitute, isn't she?
She is.
She's also doing it for money.
She's had a hard time of it, but, you know.
Yeah.
So you just got to kind of consider where the sources are of all of this information and, you know, just move on, I think. So
yeah. I think so.
Let's move on.
Let's move on. I'm ready to move on to talk about a couple other people. So basically you got sort of this in because you guys were just in high school and you saw That's Entertainment and that was like for you, ooh la la, I love this.
Yeah, and I mean, about late 78 was when Tom and I graduated high school in St. Paul. We were going to enter that fall, University of Minnesota. And, you know, we sort of became classic film buffs or fans after 74's That's Entertainment. And we had this sort of preposterous scheme that said, you know, so many of these golden age stars are in their golden years, but they're still with us. And we started a letter writing to Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire using snail mail. And that summer of 1978, they consented to see us. And yeah, I mean, so 41 years ago, we were off from Minneapolis, St. Paul to these meetings with Fred Astaire at his office, at his business manager's office, Gene Kelly at his home in Beverly Hills. And because those two were so universally revered, they like opened the floodgates to the 200, almost 250 interviews that followed. People sort of figured, other stars figured, hey, if Fred and Gene would see these two kids from the Twin Cities, we will too. And, you know, they opened the floodgates.
Yeah, they were the Willy Wonka golden ticket for really the,
yeah.
You guys were no Oompa Loompas, that's for sure.
No, exactly. Well, we came across during some of these interviews as Oompa Loompas. But Fred, really, one of the key things, as Dave said, was meeting Fred Astaire, who was universally revered. But we also took pictures with him. So, you know, we kind of proved that we had seen him through, you know, these little
you look so cute. You in your suits. In your wide ties, yeah.
But that's Fred. What we did. And then when we'd send these pictures, you know, copies of them with every query letter to get new interviews. And so the pictures sometimes put us over with these stars because they saw us with Fred. And they said, well, if Fred sees you, and I can see in this picture you actually met him, then this was the era before Photoshopping existed. So, you know, they said, well, we'll see you too. So that was kind of how it worked.
David, are you on? You're not on speakerphone or anything, right?
No, I got my ear to my phone, which they say is bad for you.
Okay. I want to talk about Ted Knight. Now, you guys, what a great story about his what he said to you and in the end. But you liked him a lot, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was the nicest guy. He was filming that show Too Close for Comfort in Hollywood after, you know, his iconic portrayal of Ted Baxter, Mary Tyler Moore. And he came onto the set. They were wrapping up before lunch. And he took us to lunch. And he couldn't have been nicer. Tom, do you want to sort of say the what happened at the end of our visit? Don't forget, we were poor college students at the time.
Yeah, we were sort of overextended. We had very, very few bucks left. We had been out, I think, interviewing stars for two straight weeks and been going all over L.A. from one house or studio to the other interviewing these people. So we were down to our last, you know, few bucks. And we, you know, kind of mentioned that to Ted, not as a sob story, but, he said, how are you guys doing? And, well, I don't know, we're going to, you know, probably eat burgers from now on or whatever. And he said, well, do you guys need some money? And we said, well, you know, I don't know. We were kind of namby-pamby about it. And then he said, well, here, I'll write you a check. It's a blank check. I'll sign my name, and you can put in whatever amount you want. Don't worry about it. And being the, you know, Midwestern rube, naive guys that we were, we didn't take him up on the offer. We were, oh, that's okay, Mr. Knight. We won't.
What a kind thing to do. See, I would have been the same as you because I was a rube from Massachusetts, and I would have been like, no, I can't. I can't. And then I would have said,
exactly.
You know, I mean, he was just high energy. And here's a guy who, you know, morphed from, playing heavies and, you know, Nazis and TV shows and all this stuff.
Combat,
MTM, where he was, you know, this brilliant comic actor. And, you know, sort of like a Leslie Nielsen. I mean, he came into his own later in life. And it was just, you know, tragic that, you know, he died at a very relatively young age of cancer. And it's a huge loss because I'm sure he would have gone on to continue to be one of our great character actors. And, you know, Tom and I always had an affinity for Mary Tyler Moore and the show.
I love the show. I own every episode.
you know, we grew up in the Twin Cities.
Oh, that's right.
You know, right. Felt like they were all part of us. And it's not in the book because it really wasn't an interview. But when Tom and I, like 1979, we were running amok at 20th Century Fox, you know, we bumped into Gavin McLeod, who was in full Captain Stubing
knee
regalia.
Socks, too.
Yeah, he was at 20th Century Fox.
Wearing his knee socks.
Oh, well, yeah. I don't know if he was in shirt. He had like the tuxedo shirt on because I have the photo.
Oh,
and, yeah. From the Love Boat.
Yeah. Right.
He was doing the Love Boat. And, you know, the second time and I said, hey, we're from the Twin Cities, Mary Tyler Moore Country. I mean, he couldn't have been nicer. He embraced us. He took us on the set. And the secret is told. Not much of it was actually shot on a ship. The pool, most of it was in sound stages at Fox. But again, he couldn't have been nicer. And then Ed Asner. I mean, what a sweetheart that guy is.
I interviewed him. I adore him.
Yeah. He's a wonderful guy.
Incidentally,
he said that Ted Knight was the funniest man he had ever met. And he said he, in between scenes, in, you know, at downtime during the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Ted would keep everyone laughing. He had everyone in stitches all the time, the whole cast.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yep. I mean, Ted was just wonderful that way.
And Ed, you know, Ed was, you know, he's to be 90. They just had a birthday for him, but he's officially 90, I believe, on the 15th of this month. And, I mean, talk about working. The guy, it was here in my hometown now of Milwaukee, doing a dramatic play reading just like 3 months ago. So I got together with him. I gave him a copy of Hollywood Heyday, and he was thrilled. And, again, just – I call him an American treasure.
He is an American treasure. We got engaged after I told him that he has this curmudgeon webpage, and he was laying in there in his bathrobe. And I said, you know, you have really cute toes. I got to tell you that, Ed. Yeah. He and I, that since then, he just kind of
he's
was
a teddy bear, right?
Oh, I
he's
love him. Bear. I would have married him. He said he was sending me an engagement ring, but alas, it never came. But
he's
a nice Jewish
guy from the Midwest.
I love him, and he was just a darling. He's right there, and I talked to his daughter, and she told me they were on the road. They'll be back in December, and she said, "Just contact me then, and Dad will talk to you then again." Because I want to ask him, "Where's my ring? Damn it!"
Yep.
But he was a doll, and he is a doll, and funny. Yeah. Funny. I adore him.
Yeah.
Adore
a dry
him.
Sense of humor.
Yes. You know what I asked Ed? I asked him, did Gavin McLeod ever have any Mary Tyler Moore people on the Love Boat? And he said, I don't think so. He said, if he would have asked me, I would have gone on. So.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'll have to Google that because it's like.
Because it's like a rogues gallery of, you know, it was most of the old Hollywood stars that were, you know, playing summer stock at that time. Like Van Johnson and Virginia Mayo and all those. I mean, pretty much everyone was on that show.
Yeah, Jane Wyman. She played Nun. Vincent Price, Joan Blondell. I can just think.
Jane Kingley. Yeah,
there were so many wonderful people on it, but it was a funny, because I was like, why wouldn't he have you guys on? And then Ed started pondering that too, but I'm sure he got over it in a minute. Okay, but we all love the MTM people. How old was Ed when he died?
I think he was 68, not even 70.
Yeah, was he that old? I thought he was in his 50s.
No, I think he was in his 60s.
He was in his 60s.
Wasn't he dying? He died while the series was in production.
Yeah, well, he had cancer. I know that, but your listeners are probably googling it while we're talking. You know?
Yeah, I don't think too close for comfort lasted that many seasons. Certainly not as long as Mary Tyler Moore Show. But
no, and it certainly wasn't, you know, the best showcase for Ted Knight.
No,
he was the dad, and you know these two.
He was a cartoonist, if I recall.
Yeah. And it just wasn't his thing, but it was successful. Okay, on to another person who I love, Lucy, but I have always heard and seen when she has done some interviews that she is not a barrel of laughs. So tell us about your visit with Lucy.
She always had that sort of, you know, two-pack cigarette voice, too. I would say that, you know, she was a tough cookie, and she was all business and all seriousness when we met with her at her home in Beverly Hills. But I always say the asterisk, and we always say it's explainable or understandable, is that Lucy became the first female mogul in the entertainment industry. So when you look at what she and Desi built with Desilu Productions, you know, not only were they acting in I Love Lucy, they were behind a desk making business decisions. I mean, if you look at Desilu from Star Trek to The Untouchables to Mannix to a number of shows.
They did all those shows? I knew that they did Miss Brooks or The Teacher, Eve Arden one, and maybe an Ann Southern one or something like that. But I didn't know that they did the heavy-duty drama kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, I mean, there was Desilu Playhouse in the 1950s. That was like a dramatic show, and that's what spawned Elliot Ness and Stack and The Untouchables.
Wow!
And that was a Desilu Playhouse that was greenlit by Desi Arnaz. But I mean, Lucy, you know, sold the production company to Paramount's parent in the late '60s for $18 million, which people probably think is nothing now, but $18 million in the '60s was a huge sum of money. So she was a mogul. She said, "Hey, I get the scripts from our writers, I go on the set, and I do my job." She wasn't an ad libber, and she said, you know, yeah, we remember the candy and the factory and all the goofy stuff. She said, if you look at the hundreds of episodes, there's only a handful in which we were doing those pratfall goofy predicaments.
Right.
And she said there was no ad libbing. We just came in, great writers, and we did our job.
And I have to say, there was great writing. I watch it. I still laugh my head off. I got my stepdaughter into it when she was a kid, and she was like, her only complaint then was, why isn't it in color? But that's
of course. That goes they did term. Colorize a few. They did colorize a few.
I think they did. I think they found
Christmas
like that's exactly
something.
Right. The lost Christmas episode.
Yeah.
And Lucy, but I have to say, she was tough on her guests after she left Desi, and she did her own Lucille Ball show and things like that.
Here's Lucy. The Lucy show, and here's Lucy.
Yes.
She's a staple and a huge commodity at CBS for that 20-year period, really from the early 50s to the late 60s. She had a successful, highly rated 20-year run. So, I mean, there's really nothing that she couldn't do. She was gold to
CBS really was.
For two decades.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
And, you know, she made stars and
I thought that was really great of her. She had Barbara – remember, this is one of my favorites, the Country Club Dance. when they moved to Connecticut and Barbara Eden's in it.
Yeah, young. Yep.
Yes, and she chose Barbara Eden as one of her people, talents that she chose to, I don't know if it was classes or something like that, but Barbara Eden was one of her people. And I think Robert Osborne was one of her people as well.
Robert Osborne, yeah, exactly. She was very close to Robert Osborne. And Osborne was actually in a Beverly Hills episode and everything. And I think Lucy actually nurtured him or encouraged him to take the route that he ended up taking as a, you know, a columnist, film historian and things like that. I believe that's what I heard. But Lucy was a star maker. And, you know, Mike Connors, who's in the book, basically said that CBS was going to cancel Mannix. It was called something else at the beginning, and Lucy was a huge fan of his and went to bat at CBS, where she had so much clout, and said, no, give this guy Mike Connors in the show a chance. And of course, it had a almost 200 episode run on CBS, so it was hugely successful. But that was because of Lucy.
She also did that with Star Trek. There were not a lot of people that thought Star Trek had any legs at all.
Can you imagine?
It's interesting. So all those Trekkies out there really have Lucy to thank for standing behind that series, and making sure it got on TV.
And look at
Exactly. It's a multi-billion-dollar franchise. And, you know, the other thing that Lucy did was tear down the little bit of the wall, the very big wall that existed back in those days about if you're a movie star, you stay in movies. You don't do television. And she got John Wayne and William Holden to do those walk-ons and cameos.
And Van Johnson, Cornell Wilde. She got a lot of people on.
And
Orson Welles.
Exactly. She did that. And if you look at the book, you know, people like Ernie Borgnine, who's in the book, or Robert Wagner, these guys had to be convinced that they should leave the film business to do TV. And because they didn't want to, they thought there was that stigma. And of course, Wagner had a hugely successful run on a number of shows. And, you know, what would Ernie Borgnine be without McHale's Navy?
Right.
I thought that, Lucy, and you know, she gave Desi a lot of credit for that, too, because he was a very good businessman.
Yeah,
he was.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
That's why people were like, oh, you know, sort of like an Abbott and Costello. I talked to Lou Costello's daughter, and she was saying, you know, everybody was puffing her father up, you know, and telling him, you know, you made him and, you know, you whatever, you know. And it sort of was like that where they were saying that Lucy always had he had no talent. If you look at the show, those four meshed perfectly.
Oh,
you know,
gosh, yeah.
He was funny, too. But he, you know, it was just Fred and Ethel and Ricky and Lucy. They were perfect.
Yeah,
so,
even though, you know, Vivian Vance and William Frawley hated each other.
Yes.
And he was like, how many years older was he? He was many decades, I think, older than she was.
He called her some nasty names, and she called him an old fart. And pretty much.
But the chemistry was chemistry worked. It was
wonderful, and they had to have known that they were fabulous together. Okay, I'm going to ask you about this person. I don't really want to talk about this person. We'll leave some stuff here. What was your time like with Jacqueline Bisset? Because she comes across to me as a person who would not be very forthcoming, and I'm surprised you guys got to interview her.
Yeah, she wasn't very forthcoming. She was she was guarded when we met her. It was in her house. I think she still lives there on Benedict Canyon. And, you know, she was, you know, she's one of the most beautiful movie stars ever. I mean, gorgeous when we met her back in the, I think it was
90s. Early 90s. Yeah, I think
early
so. 90s. Yeah. Yeah,
and
she was wearing those leather lycra, you know, skin tight pants. And
Hubba Hubba, you guys.
Being our age and raised, you know, growing up on the Deep and, you know, all those things. I mean, man, you know, she was right up there, you know.
Yeah, but the interview sort of went south when her dog, you know, started to get kind of randy with her. I mean, like he was jumping on her.
He was humping her leg.
Working his way up, you know. Boy. So it was, and she had to put him in another room. And then the dog was yelping and yowling, and then she sort of had to cut the interview short. She was very apologetic. She just said, hey, I don't know what's wrong with him, but, I don't know if we can continue to do this. So we, it was a truncated interview slightly, but we we exited, and that was that. But she was nice.
Yeah.
And,
I remember, Tom, and again, I think it's in the interview that, you know, the camera loved her. She was extremely photogenic. She, of course, made, you know, Bullet, with Steve McQueen and, you know, a number
Day for
of,
Night with Truffaut. She was wonderful. She's fluent in French.
And she had a lot of, you know, A-list significant directors that directed her. But if I recall, she really didn't have much positive things to say about these great directors or how they actually directed her. And I think George Cukor, the legendary ladies director, did his final film with her and
Rich and
Candace Bergen.
And
exactly.
My boyfriend, but David Selby, we can't forget him.
Yeah, so, I mean, she wasn't extremely – she didn't think the directors made the most of her abilities, whether it's how they photographed her or the, you know, amount of opportunity for acting. I mean, could she have been a bigger star? Could she have made more A pictures? Potentially, but, you know, who knows?
Right.
Yeah.
But she was beautiful. And I've seen pictures of her recently. She still is. I don't think she ever had any work done. And she is absolutely gorgeous.
No. And she's I believe she's about 78 now.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe. Yeah. It's so
I know.
She was at the TCM Festival last year that I attended here in Hollywood. And she introduced the film Day for Night, the Truffaut film that she made years and years ago. And she was great. I mean, I think she's game for interviews. interviews. I mean, it's certainly a TCM interview where she introduces a film and there's a packed house at the Chinese Theater. That will, you know, she won't say no to that. But yeah, she wasn't very forthcoming about her personal life. We didn't probe that much, but I think
she was with the dancer.
Alexander Gudinov, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You remember, Gudinov was actually a heavy in the first Die Hard movie.
Yes. Yeah. He was also in a horrible movie that Tom Hanks did that was like something like, I think it was supposed to be like a remake of Mr. Blanding's Bill's Dream House.
And Lonnie the Carrier.
Yeah. It's horrible. Yeah. But
I mean, do you remember? I mean, the thing that's, I remember about Jacqueline Bisset was we talked about, you know, the scene that captivated the world was, you know, her wet T-shirt thing from The Deep, which left little to the imagination.
Right. Perky.
And, yes. Yes. And we told her how when it was screened on some local TV station or something, they actually had like little black, like almost like it was tape marks
over
her nipples.
Oh, yeah.
And she thought, she was very amused by that and said, wouldn't that actually draw more attention to the situation?
You would think. Jeez.
Yeah,
well,
right. You know,
it's so funny, boy.
And of course,
she said that they had done that for a reason. I mean, that, you know, she was in a wet T-shirt. She was swimming in the Bahamas or wherever it was. So, the you know, the whole nipple erection thing was part of the scene. And why cut it out?
I mean, it's not like it was vulgar or, you know, it's
– No.
Today, of course, it's tame.
People would laugh, you know, like, oh, please.
No.
It's more of a joke when, you know, you have something taped over or blurred out on the screen.
It is. It's ridiculous. I never, you know what? I don't even think I saw the movie, but I've seen the posters and they certainly.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
On her.
I bet the YouTube has that clip.
Yes. You met someone who I like a lot. She just didn't do musicals. She did straight movies, and one of my favorite noirs she did was Tension, Sid Charisse. I love it.
Yeah.
Was she nice?
Yeah. She was very nice. She lived in with Tony Martin, her husband of many, many years. He was in the they lived up in on the Wilshire Corridor, which are these very, very nice penthouse apartments. And she was up there. And, you know, the thing was, is that, you know, she was a famous dancer at MGM. She partnered with Astaire & Kelly in a lot of musicals, Singing in the Rain and Silk Stockings and It's Always Fair Weather. And she was in her 70s when we met her, and she came right to the door. I mean, she's just so elegant and poised and beautiful. She had not lost any of that sort of, you know, balletic equipoise that you know, you had. You could just tell she was a dancer, the way she, you know, brought us into the, you know, the living room. And, you know, she was just grace personified. And
talking about
very, very nice.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, she actually, we had our first book, Reel to Reel, came out in 2004. And she and Shirley Jones both wrote forewords to that. So, again, Sid was extremely kind and extremely generous with her time with us. And Tom mentioned those Wilshire corridors. The book, there's three that come to mind that live almost neighbors within different high rises on that Wilshire area. That was Eva Marie Saint, where we met with her.
Love her.
What a class act.
Yeah.
What a class act. Sid Charisse. Of course. And then the third that was a relatively new interview, probably within the last 6-7 years, was the Tan Man himself, George Hamilton.
Mr. Tan Man. Yeah, he's a riot.
Yeah, and he tells very ribald, you know, funny stories about the 50s. And when he started, he came in about the Robert Evans era into the end of the studio system. And, you know, he told some good stories, too.
Yeah, he was in Where the Boys Are. And,
Yeah.
Lots of flicks.
Light in the Piazza.
Yeah, that last Arthur Freed produced film, with Olivia de Havilland,
And
and the
one of your vivacious.
Yes, of course.
Tell the story. I think this is a riot. The Yvette Mimieux story. I think that's, and you told RJ, and he liked that story too.
Oh, well, Tom, do you want to say this?
Yeah. We were at Stanley Donen, the director, co-directed Singing in the Rain. He did Two for the Road. He did Charade, wonderful director. And we had an early morning interview with him in Bel Air, where he lived. And, you know, we got into the – we were dressed to the nines. We always showed up in suits and ties and buff shoes and the whole thing. And it was an early morning for L.A. It was about 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. interview. And we were directed into his den, which was just festooned with – all kinds of great lobby cards from all of his movies. And it was just really a Singin' in the Rain memorabilia. It was great. And we were in there waiting, you know, kind of playing with his two German shepherds that were shedding all over us. When
over your nice new suits.
Yeah, we kind of looked like Yeti.
Good thing they were polyester.
Yeah. And,
good.
no, and then, you know, the two French doors swing open and Yvette Mimieux runs in and she's completely nude. And we're like, he had married her. He was married to her at the time. And we were shocked. I mean, we were just, oh my God. And then she screamed and ran out. And then we heard, you know, kind of, you know, in the next room or down the corridor, they were in this gigantic fight, you know, like she was probably reaming them out for like, who the hell are these guys in your den? And I thought you were there. And so when Stanley finally came into the den and we met him, he was just all PO'd. He was really mad. And he sort of took it out on us, even though we were the innocent parties. We didn't know what was going on. And so he was very monosyllabic in almost every answer. We'd ask him, like, you know, Singin' in the Rain, what was that directing it like with Gene Kelly? It was fine. Next question. You know,
oh,
I mean,
no.
It was just like.
And you did nothing.
Sort of antagonistic.
Yeah, you were just sitting there, you know, and all of a sudden.
Yeah, we were innocent. I mean, we were, you know, captivated by it all.
Of course.
We yeah, I mean, my God, it was better than even seeing, you know, Jacqueline Bisset in The Deep. I mean, this was the real thing.
This was.
I mean, what was her character
suit.
In The Time Machine, Tom?
Weena.
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 To see Weena. What was it? Weena and the Ron.
Yeah, Weena and the Ron. Yeah, no, I, yeah.
Your
yeah.
Weena no,
you
saw Weena and the Ron.
I mean, you know, he was like a sparring partner. I mean, Stanley. And Stanley, who just passed away about a year ago, was sort of, I mean, arguably, you know, sort of the last of that era. I mean, yeah, you have Kirk and Olivia de Havilland and Leslie Caron, but one, so as far as the director of those MGM musicals, he was the last one of note. Yeah. And, you know, he was extremely prickly and defensive. And then about 4 years ago, when he was, you know, late 80s, we saw him at his penthouse in New York. And, you know, of course, fortunately, he didn't remember our exchange of 35 years earlier. But yeah, I mean, he was, he certainly had longer answers to our questions. And it was a better situation cut to, you know, 40 years later.
Yes, well, and
yeah,
there was
Elaine
no
May.
Nude. Yeah,
yeah.
No.
Was,
no.
Elaine May, who he was with at the time, did not rush in nude, so there was no reason
oh,
for
oh, he was with Elaine May? Who knew that?
That was his last girl. Yeah, that was his, they had a relationship for like
For many years. So, and yeah, he was great. He was really wonderful.
And you have a cute picture of him, you guys.
Yes.
An updated picture. I put it on my page.
Yeah, we had the 2 year. Yeah, the early and then
the cute polyester suits with the big ties, and then you two handsome big lugs next to Stanley Donen. I love that.
Yeah.
RJ didn't like him, though. That was one thing.
No.
That was the only person he said he really didn't like. And I saw his reasoning for that, so I get it.
Well, and, you know, that's a lot. You know, there are film buffs who, you know, it's the Gene Kelly versus Stanley Donen camps, which, again, is all sort of like inside baseball. Who did what scene, who did what
format.
I mean, I think Stanley proved himself as a relatively young man that, yes, he was got his internship or mentorship from Gene, learned the industry and the ropes from Gene. But I think his work as a solo director stands on his own.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful stuff. He's a great director.
He
and,
was.
But, you know, together, the way they partitioned whatever tasks they had to do with the three movies that they co-directed, it worked. And, you know, again, why quibble with it or why try and parse it out? It's impossible.
Well, you know,
their final collaboration, it's always fair weather. I mean, there's probably a lot of your listeners who either haven't heard of it or haven't seen it or haven't seen it in years. I mean, I think it holds up remarkably well and it's a fun movie. And if you haven't seen It's Always Fair Weather, I'd encourage people to do that.
Yeah, Sid Charisse is in there.
Yeah.
So she's the romantic interest of Gene, and she does a great solo number in there. There's just wonderful moments in there. And it's very funny. And it's, you know, it skewers early television, and a lot of that stuff is doesn't date. It's still pretty topical, the laughs about what they're skewering.
So I haven't seen it. I'm going to check it out.
Oh, yeah, you must see it.
I think you'd like it a lot. It's a lot of fun.
He does that remarkable roller skate number.
Oh, God, can you imagine? I'd be on my butt.
And it's their only, it's in CinemaScope widescreen. So, and Michael Kidd might have been his only on-screen performance as a actor and dancer, but, you know, he's obviously terrific. Dan Daly does some of his best work in that as well.
I like Dan Daly.
The club with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean.